Hello there, folks. Hope you've had a good week. We're already at the midpoint of Season 2. And as promised, and whether you like it or not, for the next three episodes, we're going to look at the weird history of eels. Now, there can't be that much to be said about eels, can there? You might be thinking, well, yes, there can, and that's why I'm doing it. No, but it's a fair question. But eels are flipping weird. Everything they do is strange, and as a consequence, our relationship with them, more so in the past than today, is also flipping weird. You may think of them as creepy, slimy things, but I will hopefully convince you otherwise over the coming three episodes. Eels used to make up half of the animal biomass in freshwater habitats in the British Isles, but now they're on the IUCN critically endangered list, so they're rubbing shoulders with the western lowland gorilla and the Bornean orangutan. Yet, it is still legal to fish for them. In fact, elvers, that's the name of a baby eel, they're the only freshwater fish fry that are still legal to fish. Weirdly, however, it seems that by eating them, we might just save them, which seems a bit of a paradox. But this is a special case, as you will soon see. I first became interested in eels and elvers during my master's degree, when I studied elvers in Mull, Scotland. The study was the first thing I ever got published. So, you know, elvers and eels have a special place in my heart. They were a very important foodstuff, though. In fact, so important that they were used as a form of currency. More on that next week. This week, we're going to look at the first stage of their life cycle when they are eel fry. Elvers, they're sometimes called glass eels because they're completely transparent. They were a very important foodstuff for those down in the south of England, especially the southwest and particularly Gloucestershire. And I got the chance to go down there to that beautiful county and go elver fishing with Dave Smith, better known, at least for those in the business, as Elver Dave, all the way back in April 2021. It was the tail end of lockdown, but because we were outside, I could actually meet him in person and do a proper interview. I also wanted to get hold of some elvers myself and cook them up, but I couldn't let an opportunity like that go to waste. Right, well, here we go. Eel Special Part 1, elvers. Okay, I want us to look at the life cycle of the eel. This week we're looking at the start of the life cycle, the elver stage, which is possibly the weirdest and most magical part of an eel's life. But before we look at elvers in particular, let's have a look at the whole weird life cycle of the European eel, Anguilla anguilla, that's its Latin name, because that's what we're talking about here. They're not to be confused with the marine moray eel. They're a different fish altogether. Every springtime, on the western half of Britain's rivers, we received, under the cover of dark, a migration of millions upon millions of tiny glass eels, appearing as if by magic in the estuaries. In the rivers of southwest England, the Severn being the main one, they were found in such vast amounts that folk come down to the riverside and fill their pillowcases with them, take them off to eat. These elvers travelled in huge, long, jelly-like groups. Here's a description by a Dr. Hastings in the 1930s. In the month of April, the shores of the Severn are annually darkened with innumerable quantities of elvers, which are seen fringing on the sides of the river in a black ascending line, which appears in constant motion. When the elvers appear in the river, they are taken in great quantities. These long cordons of elvers were called eel fairs, and in fact that's where we get the word elver, eel fair, from. There were always so many of them, they were taken for granted. In the 1940s, the food historian Dorothy Hartley said of the elver fishing and its sustainability, "There is no fear of the fishing of these elvers destroying the future of eels if the main shoal, which sweeps up the channel, is left untouched." Those that weren't fished by humans or herons, or gobbled up by pikes, swam upstream, climbing up locks and dams. Many died and dried and stuck to the rocks and wood, giving those behind them a ladder upon which to climb. Those that survived grew up into adult yellow eels, who after a few years, all this depends on how cold the water is and how much food there is, but when they feel ready and properly fattened up, they transform themselves into silver eels, ready for the migration downstream, back down the rivers and back out to sea. And this brings us to our first mystery. Where were these eels going and where were the little elvers coming from? Well, a chap called Johannes Schmidt was obsessed with this question and it took over his life for 25 years. They were obviously swimming to the sea to spawn and the young eels were swimming back from the spawning grounds, but where was it happening? Well, he backtracked the elvers by boat only to find that they just seemed to magically disappear. Upon further examination, he found they were metamorphosing from one form to another, from a creature folk had previously assumed to be a completely different species, the Leptocephalus, a strange willow-shaped fish with a prominent toothed hinged jaw. And it was these little fish that were turning into Elvers. It was a real eureka moment. He backtracked these strange fish to the Faroe Islands, where they were about 7 centimetres long. He eventually traced them back further and further, all the way back to the Sargasso Sea, where by now they were just a half a centimetre long. And he realised this willow leaf shape adapted them to swimming the very long distances, the thousands of miles, and it takes the larvae 3 years to make the journey as they metamorphose into Elvers. When they reach the coast, detect the change in salinity as the fresh water pours into the sea. Well, I went down to Tewkesbury in April 2021 at the spring high tide. It's the peak of the Elver season, and I met up with the traditional Elver fisherman, Elver Dave, who, by the way, is a traditional fisherman not just of Elvers, but Zander and also Pike. He's also an active member and practitioner of the Seven Eel Management Plan. But on my way in, I stopped to drink in the Atmos at the Severn Estuary just to put into perspective the journey these tiny fish were making.
You can hear my squidgy footprints beneath. I've just turned up at the Severn Estuary. To my left, it is travelling down to the Atlantic Ocean. To my right, it's going up towards Tewkesbury, Gloucestershire. I see lots of lovely wading birds. It's a beautiful day. There's a great big rain cloud moving my way, but apart from that, beautiful sun, fluffy clouds, crepuscular rays are shining down. It's excellent. But the reason I've come here is because I wanted to see where those Elvers are swimming from. They're coming from the Atlantic Ocean. The scientist Johannes Schmidt in the 1910s followed Elvers down, not this river, but his local river. He was from the Netherlands. He followed them back, he got obsessed. He got interrupted a little bit by the First World War, but he traced them back. He had to get into sailing boats, traced them back out into the sea. He found that they had metamorphosed. He got to the Sargasso Sea, the Bermuda Triangle, and there he couldn't find the source. He knew, probably with quite a few lost ships and planes, they were lost somewhere in the Bermuda Triangle. That's where the spawning grounds were. More recently, the University of Maine has come closest to finding out the source of the Elvers in that Sargasso Sea in the Bermuda Triangle. They reckon it's where the warm and cold waters meet. They got their boats, they got their radars. They found on their radar a large, black, dark cloud. They reckon they found the spawning grounds. They sent down nets and tanks to do a clean sweep of the place, pulled them up, and they were all empty. Still, nobody has found out where they are. Still, no one knows how they found their way there or how they find their way back to Europe. It's all very strange. But you can see how somebody like Johannes could have just got completely obsessed by moving back a little bit further, a little bit further, taking him almost to North American mainland. It's crazy. It's hard to imagine that during this high tide where I'm here now, that just waiting in the brackish waters are millions and millions of glass eels waiting to come up. In fact, the majority of them won't have come up because the weather's been so cold. Maybe tonight is a beautiful day. Maybe tonight would be the night that they come en masse. Oh, I've just seen the first swallow as well. Oh, sorry, that ruined my dramatic finish. And now it's starting to rain. I'm going to go. Ah!
I managed to find Elver Dave, and we're on the bank of the River Severn.
So last time I saw an elder, Dave, I was in on the Isle of Mull. And there weren't very many. We were digging for them for 3 days. And I think we found 18. Am I going to see more than 18 today?
I'm hoping we're going to see more than 18 in one shot.
Okay.
A shot is when you tip the net out.
Sure.
It's a bit early, yeah, before the tide. You know, the tide's got another probably hour and a half before it gets here. But sometimes you have a little go. They feel the vibration of the tide coming. So they get up and have a little go before tide comes. So we'll put the nets in and give it 10 minutes and then we'll see what we get a rough gaze in and what we're going to get.
Okay.
If anything.
Great.
So the ideal thing is a good bit of flow coming through your net. Because the other's ideal is to migrate.
Sure.
So they're swimming against the flow. If you've got no flow in a slack water, they lose their bit of migration. They tend to not swim in that slack water. So they like the water on their nose so they can feel it and swim against the flow.
Yeah, so directionality.
Yeah, yeah. So okay. A good tump has got good flow on it.
Right, okay.
You know, you could go down there 20 yards, somebody could put their net in and not catch nothing, and you'd be here with a bit of flow and you could catch 300 or 400.
So is that why the high tide's so important? Because is that providing the flow?
The high tides, what the high tides do is they're providing a vehicle for the fish to travel on. So the idea is, like I said, just before the tide comes, half hour, they tend to feel the vibration of that tide. And they will get up and have a little go. And all they're feeling is the tide come in. When the tide comes, the idea is they all get up, jump on the free ride, go up the middle, keep going until the tide ebbs and turns. And then when it gets too strong in the middle, they drift into the sides, and that's when you start catching them.
I see. And is this when you see like the big eel fairs? Is that right? When you like see a great big stream, like a giant eel of made up of tiny little elvers? Is that when you get like
a stream of them? Yeah, you can get a stream of them in the river. Don't see them so much these days. Although it did happen last year.
Oh, really?
Upriver, there was probably a good stream of elvers, probably 5 foot wide, and it probably stretched for a mile.
Wow.
Wide,
yeah.
You know, that was a lot of elvers in the river last year.
So it's obviously working, because, I mean, it's probably, what, 13 years ago, and what, the population had dropped by, what, 98% or something?
They come out with these figures. I'm not quite sure where they get the figures from, because there isn't nothing recorded, but they are saying in the 80s it took a dive big time. But on the Severn, we got a really good recruitment, and we have done for the last 15 years. You know, we got more fish than we need. Because we've got too many and they're going to die, get them out, and restock in Europe, which we was doing before Brexit.
Sure.
So they were buying them for restocking in Holland.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a huge mess, isn't it?
And of course. So then we thought, okay, Brexit, we're getting that done. We've got a good recruitment. We can come out there, we have our own market, we'll sell it to Asia. Asia would then fund the restocking in this country, and it wouldn't cost anybody any money. UK Glass Eels offered to sell 40% to Asia, and then they would pay for restocking the 60% in the UK.
Right.
So it wouldn't cost in government or EA any money.
You're not relying on charitable handouts.
No.
It's sustainable ecology and it's sustainable business, which is what you want.
But obviously, because of the DEFRA and CITES are saying they're critically endangered, they won't allow us to export to Asia.
Right.
And we can't export to Northern Ireland because there's a protocol with the EU.
So if it's not, you don't have to answer this, if it's not a personal question, what's your incentive for doing this year? You haven't got any elvers to sell, have you?
No. We haven't got any place to sell. We've got elvers, we've got plenty of elvers.
Yeah.
But we've got nobody to sell to, because UK Glass Eels can't sell to Asia. We can't sell to Northern Ireland. There's nobody in the UK to buy any elvers. So the handful of fishermen that are out are purely doing it to restock this elver, or rewild. So any I catch tonight, okay, it's still okay to eat them.
Yeah.
It's not illegal. It's still okay to eat them.
Yeah.
So we get feeds for people. So I give a feed to an old lady who was 97 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a feed yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And it broke her heart, because she felt she would never, ever get a feed of elvers in her life again. I always used to get the father-in-law feed, no matter what the price was.
Mm-hmm.
I would always get him a feed every year when he was alive. And a lot of the fishermen do that. There's certain people they get feeds for, just because it's a tradition. So the thing is, this year, there's no market anywhere.
So no one eats them.
No one eats them in the UK. There is people in Gloucester, but there's only so many there eat. They want to feed, just to say they want to feed. What it all boils down to with the true fisherman is the catch. So I come out here tonight hoping I'm going to get 400 or 500 alvers in one go, and then probably take it up to like a kilo, kilo and a half a shut. What they call a shut is when you empty the net. Uh-huh. That's what I come out for, because that's what I fish for. I want that buzz of catching those fish.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's why we do it. And then when we caught them, they're all trayed up. You're going to sit there and think, what are we going to do with them? We've saved them. So the next step is, tonight, we can restock them or rewild them in the ditches and dikes around here. We're allowed to do that because that's where they should be going. And it's running into the Severn. So that's what the majority of the fishermen are doing tonight, just to preserve the fishery for this year.
But there's still that kind of stigma of, because it's done in the dark, so it seems shady anyway, I suppose, by some people. And it wasn't that long ago when there was all the scandal of all the trafficking. You know, how underground did it get, or has it got, should I say? Because it's still happening, isn't it?
Yeah, apparently a lot of it was to do with, there wasn't much trafficking, well, I say trafficking on the Severn. I've never been approached by anybody who's come down and said, I'll give you £500 for your hours. And they're going to send them illegal. I've never had that. And I think you'll find there's no other fishermen on the Severn either. A lot of the illegal trafficking is done in France, Portugal, Spain. I wouldn't say, I haven't been approached by anybody to buy alvers for illegal selling. And the majority of the fishermen wouldn't do that on the Severn.
That's good to hear.
Put that net in there where you're still. Put the bucket in there where you're still.
So Dave has pulled out his net, and there's some little elvers. Hello.
A few to start with. That's a little bit early yet, so we'll come back and have another go in a minute.
Well, you've just done in one little sweep there what I did in one day. Back in the day. Is elvering, is that even a word, a family tradition?
Yeah, tradition. My dad done it, his dad done it, my uncle done it, and I used to go with them. My two sons at the moment are doing it. And hopefully my grandson has been out in the water, so hopefully they'll carry on as well. We can preserve the fishery, which is, you know, it's in a good position at the moment, the fishery. We've got good recruitment every year, so there's no reason why we shouldn't preserve it.
And most of the elver fisher, what, men and women, I suppose, are they all kind of long, like, do they have family traditions too, or are they some complete, you know, green newbies doing it?
No, you don't get many new people coming. It's diehards now, you know. Fishermen like myself and other people who've been doing it all their life, and their family have been doing it all their life. There's no money for the young people to come in to do this. You know, they can earn more blogging on YouTube or whatever than coming out on the freezing cold riverbank for 5 or 6 hours and earn £2.50. You know what I mean?
Sure. I guess, well, this year is a funny year because of Brexit, but normally it's kind of a, you make a decent amount of money or nothing. Because of just the window you've got to collect them in large amounts.
Yeah, the window we got is a lot shorter now because obviously there is a season put on it now, which is from March the 1st till May the 25th. The problem we got this year is there's only a handful of fishermen out. So you've got probably 10 miles of river, both sides, you know, so 20 miles of river, where normally there'd be 400 fishermen stretched out along that river. Now we've only got probably 20 or 30 blokes.
Right.
So the fish could be, you know, they could be going past over there now.
Yeah,
there's nobody over there. Yeah, nobody over there. So the problem we got this year is we normally keep a record. We've got to keep a record of everything we catch. Mm-hmm. So the environment agency looks at that record and they can tell if the season's getting better or worse or whatever. So this year, through no fault of anybody's, it's going to show is one of the worst years on record. And it could actually be one of the best years.
Because there's just so many variables to consider.
Like I say, there could be 2 ton of fish going up there now on the other side. Yeah. Nobody's going to log that because there's nobody over there fishing. So all them fish, all people say, oh, that's good, they've escaped.
Yeah.
Well, no, they're not. They're stuck in that river.
Yeah.
They can't get out.
Yeah.
So all the predators are going to come and eat them.
Yeah, so the herons would love it, wouldn't they?
90% of them are going to die.
Yeah.
Everything's against us this year. We're trying to do a bit of rewilding and all that, but... You know, people got to go work in the morning. They ain't going to sit on the riverbank for nothing.
No, there's only so far goodwill's going to take you, isn't it?
Yeah. A lot of people do it. You know, they come out for the hour and to earn a bit of pin money, what we used to call it pin money years ago, where mm-hmm. you buy your fags and your beer, you know, that's what they pay for. Now people are coming out and they say, okay, if I can fish all season and pay for my holiday, right. you know, that's saved me doing overtime and struggling to pay for an holiday.
It all makes perfect sense. Yeah. We're not relying on, you're not relying on some kind of charitable organisation because it's a viable business. Yeah. Or it is just some extra pocket money, if that's fine. Yeah. And it's all out in the open and everyone gets data and a good chunk of them gets to swim upstream and have a good old life.
You're going to, like I say, you're going to have, they reckon on the Severn that there is, over the last 10 years, there is too many fish. So what happens is you get a biomass of fish that can't get out. So they're going to be eaten. Well, why are we going to leave them fish in the river to be eaten when the fishermen could get them out? The Dutch, I was speaking to somebody in Denmark now on Twitter, and he said, we want your alvers, you know, we need your alvers to restock our rivers. You know, we're just going to leave them to die in the river. You know, how is that
nuts.
Possible?
It's nuts.
And then we're going to have a look at the trees.
All right, let's see what we got. Because when I saw the great big net, I was thinking, oh, there's going to be a million. There's going to be millions. But I guess it's big because they're so thinly spread out.
Yeah.
It's just occurred to me.
What's the going rate for a kilo of elvers?
At the moment, nothing.
Oh, shit, it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if I was asking you this last year, what was the going rate for elvers?
The going rate last year was probably about £120-£150 a kilo.
Oh, okay.
To nothing.
To nothing. Literally nothing this year.
I swapped a feed yesterday to a chap, which is probably about, I would say, you know, an old point mug.
Yeah.
So that's a good feed.
Yeah.
And I swapped that for 12 eggs yesterday.
Shit.
And he said to me, oh, I should give you, I said, well, at the moment, eggs are worth more than elvers.
Bloody hell.
It's one of the things. There's a few fishermen turning up on the other side now, so there is. That's the most I've seen out over the last week. All they're hoping to do is catch some fish. What they do is they rewild some in the brooks and then they sell some for feeds just to get their authorization money back and their petrol money back. You know, it costs you...
How much does a licence cost?
Well, the authorization costs you £85.
That's not cheap.
No. Yeah, you won't.
Do all you kind of elver guys know each other? Are you a kind of friendly bunch or is everyone pretty...
Yeah, everybody gets on. Everybody knows where they fish. It's quite a good community. You know what I mean? Everybody's out here doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. We're all out here to make a little bit of money, out here to earn a little bit of money. And, you know, I've got respect for anybody who comes out on the river on a freezing cold night, soaking wet. When we was in Europe, because a lot of the illegal trade has been killed over there, you're getting more and more fishermen now come in and fishing legally because they didn't even know they was there half the time. They was trafficking fish. And so what's happened now is instead of France catching 60-ton, it's turning up with 75-ton. So by the time Europe filled up all their quotas, it gets to us, nobody wants them. And, you know, like I said, we've had probably the last 4 or 5 years where the station's shut because they've had too many fish. Which is a crazy thing for an endangered species. It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. And it's, I understand the global thing that, yeah, they're endangered globally. But we have got such a good recruitment here.
And it's just crazy that we've just lost our own food culture so much. There's not a single place in England or in Britain. I mean, there's an island, but Scotland, Wales or England, there isn't a single place rearing eels, farming eels.
No, Severn and Wye Smokery bought an eel farm from, I think it was Denmark. He was going to set up an eel farm in the UK because he sells smoked eel, right? But he was buying from Europe. Of course, you can't buy adult eels from Europe now, and he can't sell adult eels to Europe.
So he can't get them, and even if he could, he couldn't get them back.
No, he couldn't get them back. So individual trays.
Back in the day, would those be basically the trays that'd be going off to fishmongers?
People would just, like my dad, when he went, he would bring pillowcases.
I was going to ask, so I've brought a pillowcase in the hope that I could bring a pillowcase of Elwoods, but that's not going to happen, is it?
No. they used to put them in pillowcases because they were just selling around the streets for food. Like I say, the days of pillowcases, that was just to squash them up and get all the vomp. They kick off a bit of a, what they call a vomp, when you cast lots of them. It's like a protective thing they kick off.
It's like slimy,
yeah, slimy
mucusy.
Yeah. It's vomp, we call it vomp, so they used to put them in pillowcases. It is, yeah. And vomp water weighs a little bit than normal water, so if you can keep vomp water and pour it over the average, you can get a bit more money when you weigh them in. There's all these little tricks in.
Is an Elva net a standard net?
There is a limit to what you can have, and it's 1 meter depth, 1 meter width, and 1.25 long, and it can't be no bigger than that. That is the legal limit. Because at one time, you drive around Gloucester and they had nets bigger than your fucking car.
Yeah, I did a bit of a Google image search and found these absolutely humongous things. Yeah. So there's none of that anymore.
No, it's not, you're regulated now. If you have an oversized net, then it just gets took off you and broken up by the Environment Agency. You can understand when I say to you, we got tons of fish in here, that's going to die. Most people say, well, they're in the river, why are they going to die? You can understand, you can see the barrier now when we go back up there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You can see the barrier where they're swimming to. They can't get past it. 6 inches. I mean, they swam 2,000 miles and 6 inches is stopping them, getting them to where they want to be. And then that's when your pike, your perch, your birds, your ducks, you know, they all come in easy pickings. So, you know, 90% of them are going to die.
This is maybe the fourth sweep of his net. Oh, hoo. They're coming. And what about the actual fishing with the net? Are you only allowed to fish from the bank? Are you allowed to get on a pair of waders and wade in?
Yeah, you can fish anywhere. As long as it's a handheld net, a dip net, we call it, you can fish anywhere on the bank. You can't fish from a boat. That's illegal. Authorisation says you've got to stand there and hold your net. You can't leave it tied in or tied in.
Seems to me like that's a almost outdated rule because you're doing it for rewilding purposes. So you think they'd want you to catch as many as possible rather than... I can see how they would have thought this maybe 10, 15 years ago, but it seems a bit upside down now, upside down thinking.
Yeah. Here he is, Toy's coming there. See the water there?
Oh, right, okay.
Every now and then you'll see one there.
Hello!
So they just shake that, so as people there know, the tide's coming, you know? You see him on the, starting to swim now on top. See him?
Yeah.
So what they're doing, they're catching easy ride.
I guess as soon as it gets light, they're hiding in the weeds and under rocks from the herons and pikes and what have you.
They tend to bury their tails in the silt, in the mud, and just leave their head poking up.
Yeah.
He's starting to pick up some pace now, look.
Yeah, it really is getting fast. Oh, bat. I just saw a lovely Dorbenton's bat fly past there, I think.
Oh, yeah, plenty of bats around here. That is getting strong now, that.
Yeah. It's quite a workout.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
They're almost covering the bottom of the bucket there, aren't they?
But when you get 4 or 5 under an airmine, you get like a football in the bottom of the net of ours. You can hear them wriggling when you pull the net out. That's when
you
don't need a light or nothing.
You eat Elvers too?
Eat them.
Yeah.
Mainly the older generation eat them. There's not so many young Elvermen or people.
Mm-hmm. Are they an acquired taste?
I wouldn't say that there's not a real... It's more of a textury taste to them. You know what I mean? It's not... Because, traditionally people either cook them in bacon fat and then mix an egg with them.
I was about to ask you how you did them. So is that how you do them?
I tend to just cook them. I cook the bacon first and then take the bacon out and cook them in the bacon fat.
Sure.
And then just have them with a bit of seasoning and a bit of vinegar.
Right, okay. Top tip.
A lot of chefs do them totally different. They cook them in flour with a bit of paprika on them.
Mm-hmm. Like white bait?
Yeah, yeah. And then they're fry them in a high heat. And they taste nice, don't get me wrong.
I'm going to stop talking to you now because you're concentrating.
This is getting quite... It's not like just getting that hard over
in there. Well, I've been out about 45 minutes with Dave, but we've not reached the peak yet. Hopefully, maybe
15, 20 minutes, we might get a big sack full of eels, of glass eels, should I say.
What do you reckon my chances are of getting a feed?
Well, I could get you a feed.
All right, so if we're not successful tonight. So
save you hanging around till bloody 3 o'clock in the morning. Because, you know, I don't think it's going to happen tonight. The conditions just don't seem right.
Right, well, I'm going to toddle off, see if I can get through the fields. You might see this crashed smoking car.
Oh, a big thank you to Dave for letting me tug along. It's great work that these fisher folk are doing, making sure these tiny elvers get to swim upstream. Every elverer who had caught some elvers gave them all to the Sustainable Eel Group, who moved them upstream the next day beyond their man-made obstacles. A very tidy 1.2 million elvers, not bad for a quiet night on the river, were sent upstream. We'll look at the conservation and the work that the Sustainable Eel Group do in a couple of episodes' time. Prior to Mr. Schmidt working out where those elvers were really coming from, there was much folklore surrounding them. It was believed, for example, that elvers sprang from the hairs of horses' tails, or from the morning dew that fell from the waving barley. In fact, another name for elvers is barley eels. Rather more poignant, stroke spooky, it was thought that they were the hairs of dead sailors lost at sea returning to land. In the years before the population crash, several tons of elvers were fished annually, and they weren't just food for people, but for plants too, because there were so many of them, they used them to fertilise the fields. Folk ate bucket loads of the stuff, and I mean this quite literally. Though the knowledge of this delicacy was so localised that any folk living away from the rivers, like the Severn and the Parrot, and the surrounding marshlands, had no idea they existed. Take this old story of an elderly marsh mother who was mistaken for a witch. The story goes, an old marsh mother moved up to the countryside to where the farmer folk lived. She had with her a bucket of glass eels and put the bucket on to cook, causing an outcry from her neighbours of witchcraft. Why witchcraft? Well, because she took a pail of clear water, set it on fire, murmured some incantations. 30 minutes later, she was eating a delicious fish supper. What other explanation could there possibly be? Okay, let's have a little look at elvers in the kitchen. Now, as you may or you may not know, I got into this British food history malarkey when I started cooking and blogging every recipe in Jane Grigson's wonderful tome, English Food. The blog is called Neil Cooks Grigson, and there's 450 recipes to cook, and I am tantalisingly close to completing it. As I speak now, I am at recipe 443, so there's just 7 left. One of the recipes that's eluded me since I began it in 2007 is the recipe Elvers in the Gloucester Style. In fact, it's the very dish Dave described earlier in the episode. This was supposed to be a cookery spot, but because of the cold nights we had, the elvers eluded us. Hey ho, well, maybe next year. If you do get hold of some elvers, there is the recipe on my other blog, and there's a link in the description of the podcast. To cook elvers in the Gloucester style, it's elvers, eggs and bacon essentially, but you could coat them in seasoned flour and cayenne pepper and deep fry them just like you do whitebait. Another traditional way is to make elver cake. To do this, you simply mix your elvers with some herbs, press into reeling cakes, which are then baked or fried, like, well, a very macabre frittata, I suppose. I must admit, the thought makes me a little queasy. But this brings me on to some curious advice from Jane Grigson on the preparation and eating of elvers. Very useful if you should ever get your hands on any. This advice, by the way, comes from Jane Grigson's fish book. She says, first, to tip a big handful of sea salt into your wriggling elvers and swish and squeeze them to remove all the slime. And you need to do this 3 or 4 times. She then goes on to say, and I'm quoting her here, exhausted after an evening's work at the swirling mass, I can never face cooking them and eating them at once. She thinks elvers are delicious, but they obviously creep her out a bit, at least going by her advice on portion sizes. She says, never give people the chance to feel surfeited, because this will increase any lurking quivers of revulsion. I suppose it must be a mind over matter thing. I get the same feeling whenever I eat brain. Keep the portion small so you've eaten it all before you get weirded out. Anyway, you have been warned. Well, that brings us to the end of the first episode of my eel extravaganza. I hope you've learned a lot and are coming around to my way of thinking. The eels are just as special and amazing as they are weird and delicious. Okay, I might not have convinced you about the delicious part in this episode, but I will. A big thank you again to Elver Dave for putting up with me all of that evening. You can find him on Twitter, by the way, at Elver Dave. And thanks too to Andrew Kerr of the Sustainable Eel Group for putting me in contact with him. Next week we're looking at adult eels and their importance as a foodstuff in Britain's past, where I shall be chatting with medieval eel historian John Wyatt Greenlee. Of course, if you have any questions, comments or queries about everything from this episode, or indeed any episode in the podcast so far, please get in contact via email at neil@britishfoodhistory.com or on Twitter at Neil Buttery or Instagram at dr_neil_buttery. I'm hoping to do some bonus postbag episodes at the end of the season, remember, and I'd love to know if anyone can add anything to this episode. Have you, would you eat elvers? Can you add to any of the folklore or memories that I've mentioned today? If you can, please get in contact. Also, don't forget to like and subscribe and tell a friend or two about the podcast. And also please leave comments or ratings on whatever platform you prefer to procure your podcasts. If you like the podcast and blogs, why not treat me to a virtual coffee or a virtual pint? Or start up a monthly £3 subscription so you can access the extras that I'm always adding on my Easter eggs tab on the website, britishfoodhistory.com. I'm also adding blog posts that are just for subscribers too. Please go to the Support the Blog and Podcast tab on the website. Right, until next time, take care now, bye.